The Writer Files, a member of the Podglomerate Network.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
He was of African as well as indigenous descent. He fought in the War of 1812, not for the British or the Americans, but for Tecumseh, who was a Shawnee and kind of pan-indigenous visionary and leader who had this vision for a pan-indigenous territory that would have radically changed the geography of North America as we know it. Had the promises to him been made good on. He's then captured and is enslaved for many years in the American South, ends up escaping and founding the black community of this town in Ontario called Owen Sound, which was considered the northern terminus of the Underground Railroad.
And welcome back to The Writer Files. I am still your humble host, Kelton Reed, wishing you pages, patience, and perseverance per usual. Acclaimed debut novelist Kai Thomas spoke to me about writing historical fiction that interweaves Black and Indigenous cultures, the power of storytelling, keeping grounded in his work, and his novel, In the Upper Country. Kai is a writer, carpenter, and land steward of Soulfire Farm, a community-centered farm committed to uprooting racism and seeding sovereignty in the food system. His debut novel is In the Upper Country and described as an unforgettable story that unearths the tangled fates of two resilient women from different generations with different pasts as they reveal the deeply connected histories of Black and Indigenous peoples of North America and their relationship to the land around them. A Publisher's Weekly starred review called it a mesmerizing debut that explores freedom, family, and the interconnections between white, black, and indigenous communities in 1859 Canada. In this file, Kai and I discussed how an MFA program helped him find his confidence as a writer, the importance of mentorship, peer evaluation, and fiction workshops for honing his debut, gleaning inspiration from his cultural heritage in an old photograph, exploring lesser-known chapters of history, finding a balance between research and writing, trusting the process, and a lot more. Stay calm and write on. And don't forget, you can always support this show by heading to writerfiles.fm, where you can also sign up for email updates, get links to merch, and other resources for writers. And if you're a fan of The Writer Files, please click follow to automatically see new interviews in your podcatcher as soon as they're published, and drop us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you tune in to help other writers find us. Okay, we are back on The Writer Files, and I am honored today to be joined by an acclaimed debut novelist. I've got Kai Thomas on the line today, and I'm really excited to rap with you about all things writing and this fantastic new novel of yours.
Thanks, Kelton. I'm really excited to be here.
I can't wait to just talk about what you've been up to in the run-up to your publication day, which is fast approaching. So here we are chatting on the eve of the dropping of In the Upper Country. And how are you feeling? What's the vibe over there?
I'm really excited. I have some nerves for sure, especially being that it's the first time I've written a novel and also the first time that I have had to speak about it in a coherent way. over the course of a few different interviews. So I'm excited in that I feel that I'm learning how to do that a bit better. So you're getting me at like the fifth interview or something like that. So I'm feeling good about the role that I'm hitting. So
cool.
So yeah, I'm getting to talk about it in a new way, which is interesting. It's really interesting for me to hear how it's landing with different people, to hear the questions that different folks have. So I'm really excited to chat about it with you and to hear a little bit of your perspective and your lines of inquiry, and let's get into all of that.
For sure. I can't wait to talk about the book and its reception, and it's been really, really impressive to see. But also, want to talk about your background and kind of your life before the release of this book. Talk a little bit about how you got here, and like, you know, I know so many writers, and especially like debut authors, talk about, you know, this circuitous path to publication and kind of, you know, a life before writing. But surely this, you know, you've been writing for some time, but you also have been doing all these really interesting things, specifically, you know, as I understand it, a land steward of Soulfire Farms there. I understand that you're actually in upstate New York now.
Yeah, I live and work at Soulfire Farm, which is a nonprofit educational farm that has the mission of dismantling racism in the food system. And we run a lot of educational programs related to food and land sovereignty. And my role here mostly concerns with the infrastructure, especially as we're kind of building out a campus. So yeah, my work these days involves a lot of maintenance, hands-on carpentry, kind of groundwork type of work. So that's what I'm involved in currently. And yeah, the work, most of my focus on my career over the past 10 years or so has been in similar sort of work, doing small-scale farming related, and progressively I've kind of found my niche in that world in terms of my interest in carpentry and in infrastructure and in designing those systems of where human structures interact with the natural landscape.
That seems like all really relevant stuff now, especially given, you know, kind of these concentric circles of crises, including climate change. And of course, as you mentioned, the mission of Soulfire Farm there, to kind of working to end food apartheid. And, you know, I understand a part of that is, you know, kind of some of these food deserts that a lot of communities face as a result of kind of like longstanding systemic racism and so forth.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, that is our mission and what we do. And I find that work, it's a real blessing to work for an organization that has such a clear purpose and is so competent in its goals and in the skills that we teach people here. And it helps keep me grounded, keep me focused. I enjoy writing, but I think if I had to do that all day every day, I would feel so restless. So it's really good for me to have that more hands-on anchor in my life.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Well, I'll definitely drop a link to Soulfire Farm, of course.
Right on.
In addition to your home base there. But yeah, so talk about the writing piece. So how do you incorporate or find the time to write a novel? And, you know, before we talk about In the Upper Country and kind of the genesis of the novel, talk about, yeah, what brought you to writing? When did you decide, yes, I am going to really mine this rich vein of historical fiction, and then find a publisher?
Well, I have to credit, I did an MFA at University of Guelph, and that was a huge step for me because I had aspirations to write prior to that, and I had been doing creative writing as a hobby prior to that, but it was the training and the mentorship and just the learning how to workshop that I did over the course of that program that gave me a huge leg up. And it's not that it was the defining element in the creation of this particular work. I think a lot of work and just conceptual work went into it prior to that 2-year program, and it's been over 2 years now that since I've been out of that program.
I just got a ton of practice, so that was really key in building confidence, as I mentioned, and in the development of this book. There was a fair amount of conceptual work and just dabbling as a creative writer that I engaged in beforehand and kind of years prior to that. And there was a ton of work to do on the manuscript in the years following that. But that experience definitely anchored me as a writer and just gave me the opportunity to imagine doing this as a career. So yeah, big shout out to University of Guelph's Creative Writing MFA for that experience. And I guess in the time since that, it has just been a process of getting a couple of really good agents. I have two fantastic agents, Samantha Haywood and Shailene Knight, at the Transatlantic Agency, and they are great advocates for my work and for the manuscript, and they were able to connect me to the publishing houses. And from there, you know, again, the editors. I think throughout the whole process, I'm just so grateful for all of the different hands and the different eyes and perspectives that have helped not only shape the work, because I'm a huge proponent and I value hugely the process of call and response and hearing how my work is landing with other people and what's confusing to them, and just trying to listen to that with a very open mind. And that process was significant throughout the 2 years or so of editing and rewriting the manuscript that I had following my MFA program. So
yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm.
Always quite the process. And now you're kind of on the eve of the birth of your first novel, and that's gotta feel pretty good, as you said. Having some nerves, but of course the reception has been really, really cool to see, as I mentioned.
Yeah,
you've been compared to some peers that are kind of heavyweights, of course. And then, yeah, I mean, let's talk about the genesis of the book and quick summary. So traveling along the lines of the Underground Railroad from the American South to Michigan, from the indigenous nations around the Great Lakes region to the Black refugee communities in Canada, in the upper country is a story of family upheaval, love, and survival. And it's been described simply as the fates of two unforgettable women, one just beginning a journey of reckoning and self-discovery, and the other completing her life's last vital act, intertwined in this sweeping novel set at the terminus of the Underground Railroad. So talk a little bit about kind of, again, the genesis, how you were inspired to not only write this story, which, you know, has some deep historical roots that you must have had to research and incorporate, but also how your own cultural heritage inspired this debut.
Right. I mean, the earliest point at which I can identify thinking about writing a novel such as this was when I came across an old photograph or copy of an old photograph that was from the mid-1800s, undated, and it captured this image of a man named John Daddy Hall, who was a kind of like a semi, he developed a semi-mythological kind of character when you read about his stories. I shout out the historian Peter Myler, who has done most of the work talking about John Daddy Hall's life, but I came across this photograph, which was significant even insofar as just, you know, a photograph from the mid-19th century of a black person is something of a rarity, and this would have been the first moment in history that black folks or any marginalized peoples would have been able to represent themselves in this way with the advent of photography. So it was this really interesting kind of moment in visual culture, right? And I start to read about John Daddy Hall, and his story was just incredible. To name a few different highlights of the story of his life, he was of African as well as indigenous descent. He fought in the War of 1812, not for the British or the Americans, but for Tecumseh, who was a Shawnee and kind of pan-indigenous visionary and leader who had this vision for a pan-indigenous territory that would have radically changed the geography of North America as we know it, had the promises to him been made good on. So you have John Daddy Hall, who's this mixed black and indigenous man fighting for and with Tecumseh, is then captured and is enslaved for many years in the American South, ends up escaping and founding the black community of this town in Ontario called Owen Sound, which was considered the northern terminus of the Underground Railroad. It's right up there on the coast of Georgian Bay, which is a bay off one of the Great Lakes, and ends up living an extraordinarily long life, purportedly like 115 years old. And so I'm just reading the story. I'm like, wow, this is an incredible story. This would make for a good novel. But not only would it make for a good novel, it touches on these chapters of history and these historical relationships and dynamics that I've never seen represented in literature. I'd never seen or heard a story about a black person, what a black person's experience would have been in the War of 1812, a historical moment like that. I'd never really thought about, you know, what happened at the end of the Underground Railroad. I'd understood the concept of the Underground Railroad and you know, what purpose it served in the movement for emancipation of black people in this continent. But, you know, these communities, what were they like? Who made them up? What were the dynamics they were involved in? What were the challenges that they were dealing with? And so just all of these questions. So his life, I give a deep bow of respect to the life of this man, first and foremost for what he lived through and persevered through, and secondly for inspiring a research journey that went on to, you know, form the bread and butter of this novel.
I want to talk about the research piece, of course, and the amount of love that went into the book, but talk for a minute about how you chose the point of view. And I think, you know, part of it would be, we'll get into kind of the importance of the storytelling piece and kind of, you know, the oral traditions and so on and so forth. But yeah, talk about how you chose this daunting task.
Yeah, so I mean, I think I was interested in these varying chapters of history. I was interested in War of 1812 in particular because it struck me as a moment in history that is not very well understood, or to the extent that I learned it in school, it was very kind of vague and convoluted. You know, why people were fighting this war, what was won, what was lost, questions like that. And when I dug into it a little bit more, I was just really intrigued by how, from Black and Indigenous perspectives, it was a very monumental moment. It was a very significant moment, rather, in history of this region. I was interested in the Underground Railroad as well because, especially growing up as a Black Canadian, I, you know, these two moments in history, 1812 and Underground Railroad, are two of kind of the national myths, you could say. Not myths in the sense of they're mythological, but in the sense that these are the kind of stories that inform what, as Canadians, we think of as our national identity. And so it has to do with, in the case of the Underground Railroad, a racial tolerance that is kind of inherent to what it means to be Canadian. In the case of the War of 1812, it's this notion of, again, you know, sort of a pluralistic society. You have French, English, Indigenous people coming together to combat the invading Americans. These are like some of the stories that I grew up with. I was interested in unpacking those, and not to destroy them, but to examine them closely and look at the nuance that is inherent in them. And so I had, you know, this very wide scope of what I wanted to capture in the narrative. And so, especially in the early manuscripts, the main character, Lucinda, she was in there, but I didn't really have a concept of her being the main character or the protagonist or the anchor point for the whole story. It was much more fragmented, and it could have gone in any direction. So I liked that there was this chorus of voices. There were many different characters telling their stories, and these were interweaving. But especially in the earlier drafts of the manuscript, that fragmentation was not an asset to the storytelling, because of the feedback that I was getting from a lot of people was like, it's confusing. You know, I'm reading and I'm losing track of who's who. And I think there's probably an element, there might be an element of that still exists. But what I ended up doing to address that is really anchoring the whole narrative with the perspective of this one character, Lucinda. And so that, I think, you know, allowed me to still hold the scope of having multiple perspectives, but always bringing it back to her story. And really, at the end of the day, if I think back to what the narrative is actually doing, is it's really just following her over the course of 4 days, 4 or 5 days of her life, as she has recollections, as she encounters people who tell her stories, as she reads the narratives of other people. And so anchoring it in that way, I think, gave the narrative gave the novel some cohesion.
Well, it's been described as both precise and yet lyrical. And I think, yeah, obviously the power of interweaving these histories, you know, and doing it in such a lyrical way is ambitious, but it seems that you've succeeded and had quite a few really glowing reviews. I want to just read a couple blurbs really quick. I thought, of course, Kirkus Reviews and Star Review had said, "The harshly real and fantastic mingle in ways that recall Ta-Nehisi Coates, the water dancer. What's most impressive is Thomas's imaginative power, sure-handed, often lyrical prose, and strong, complex, resilient women." And yeah, that was probably kind of nice to get.
Yeah, absolutely. Very, very affirming. Yeah, I was thrilled. I was thrilled that, yeah, I've got some positive reception so far. And you know, and even, you know, beyond the reviewing bodies such as Kirkus or Publishers Weekly or what have you, just to be able to hear, you know, I've been reading the Goodreads reviews, and I'm interested in like what people have to say who are not necessarily recognized in that way. And it's really cool to you know, imagine and try and create something that has an intent and an aim, to see people pick up on some of the things that I was trying to do successfully, I was trying to accomplish. And yeah, it's incredibly, incredibly affirming and just a really interesting process, you know, to engage in. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on the work, of course. Your peers have had some really fantastic things to say as well.
Thank you.
And yeah, I mean, I want to talk about the power and the function of storytelling, but Yeah, I mean, I think there's something really important here about kind of, again, oral traditions. And, but, you know, there's something, maybe something has been lost in the internet age. I don't know. Talk a little bit about that. I mean, you know, folklore and medicine and, you know, you talk some about kind of witchcraft and these are things that have always had like a rich oral tradition, right? It's not like there are reams and reams of literature from that era that you could go back to and reference. But at the same time, you know, now we have access to, you know, any information we could ever desire at our fingertips. How do we connect these things, and how do we make, work like this more important, or at least more vital now?
Well, it's interesting, you know, hearing your question, the way you're formulating it. What it makes me think of is the ways in which my own experience in the digital age kind of aided in structuring it the way I did. You know, I hear you asking about, you know, the ancient, I hear you asking about the ancient tradition of oral storytelling, call and response, which is definitely what I was trying to evoke and speak to in the novel. And for me, engaging with the internet in order to do some of my research, engaging with, I don't know, YouTube videos in order to visualize certain plants or, you know, harvesting techniques or tool, like older tool use, you know what I mean? Engaging with these technologies in that way, there's a duality there. I think that the technologies of this digital age, if you kind of succumb to them, you know, my experience of it is they'll just kind of pull you apart in this fragmentary way because there's so many pulls on one's attention. And what I was trying to do was to harness that a little bit and say, you know, let me acknowledge that the distractions of the internet and of computers and screens and all these things are very real for me too. And in some ways, it's kind of how the book came to be in this style, even though I'm calling to this older era of oral storytelling. I'm also trying to work with the constant fragmentation of the digital realm in order to accomplish that. So that's what I'm thinking of. Because, and again, you know, going back to the earlier drafts that were just fragmented to the point of being confusing, I think it's a reflection of how my attention was fragmented in some way by engaging with the internet in this case. And I think that the task was, okay, you know, the internet, these technologies should be a tool like any other if I can learn to use it as such. So how can I strike that middle ground of allowing it to pull at my attention in these varying ways and still trying to structure that pull into something that is whole. So that's what your question makes me think of.
No, it's interesting because I think, as you said, like striking a middle ground between the online research and then structuring resounding prose that tells a story in a linear fashion. Talk a little bit about, yeah, what type of a writer are you? What is kind of the best writing day for you? You know, where you're really hitting your stride, where you feel like you're in flow state. Is there any research left to be done, or has that all been done beforehand? Are you mixing the two? How are you really kind of, how are you finding your stride as a writer?
That's a great question. I think for me, what I realized at a certain point is like, I'm not a historian and I had to let go of the urge to just keep reading and keep talking to people and keep researching because I didn't have the capacity to read and to know everything I wanted to know about another period of history. But there was a point at which I had to learn to draw the line, you know, and it came many, many times. You know, there'd be many times I'd be writing a scene and realize, hey, I don't actually know how this character would say this, or I don't actually know what this character would do in this circumstance, because of the limits of my knowledge about history or material culture or whatever it was. So I think, you know, there was a point at which I was like, okay, let me just write it anyways and let it be imperfect and revisit it later. And that process of coming back to it, you know, learning to get over the fear of imperfection and of, you know, flawed prose or flawed details, and just getting it down and revisiting it later, and trusting that in continuing to return to a piece, I'm going to be able to pick up what doesn't make sense, and other people will be able to pick up and alert me to what doesn't make sense or what doesn't seem right, and just trusting that process. That is really key. And in terms of my ideal day, for large chunks of the writing process, because I work full time, doing other things, I just got into a good morning routine and occasionally evening routine as well, in terms of just getting up and writing or rewriting or just reading, and just trusting that, you know, following the point in the text at which I am interested in that moment is going to be beneficial, and letting the rest of the imperfections lie until it is time to address them is the process that I landed on. And and yeah, you know, I'm not the type of person who finds it very productive to sit and write for 5-6 hours. I found it much more effective to just create a consistent process where for shorter periods of time I can revisit and rewrite and add as necessary and all of that. So that is more or less my process.
Yeah, and you're kind of finding the process in the margins, of course, and relying on your craft, because that early unpolished work has been really molded into something spectacular. Congrats. In the Upper Country weaves together unlikely stories of love, survival, and familial upheaval that map the interconnected history of the peoples of North America in an entirely new and resonant way. I could go on and on with the blurbs, but I want to pick your brain more about writing, but we do have to wrap here, and I got a fun one for you before we wrap up with your kind of advice to your fellow scribes. If you could have dinner with any author from any era, to your favorite spot, favorite restaurant in the world, who would you take? Where would you take them? All expenses paid, of course. It's on me.
Oh, thank you.
We're putting it on the corporate card.
Awesome. I love that. I'm going to say, the thing is, where I live, there's not a ton of really great options. So I'm going to say, cook at home, fire up the grill, and eat with my family as a setting. And in terms of who I would love to talk to, I was just thinking about a book that I've returned to a few times. It's called No Pain Like This Body. It's the only work by a man named Harold Sonny Ladue, who is actually from Trinidad, and he wrote this book and was kind of mysteriously murdered shortly after. And the book is just beautiful. It is one of those books that holds, you know, this vast scope of emotion, at least for me reading it. Like, I've never laughed so hard reading a book. It is intense and brutal and all of the things, and so beautifully particular in its detail that it just stands out as this phenomenal work that I feel this very personal connection to. So I would bring Harold Ladue back and have a nice Trini meal with him and my family and just chop it up.
Thank you so much for taking the time to do this. We really appreciate your words, your wisdom. I'd love to have you back and do it again sometime. And of course, I will drop a link to your home base there, KaiThomasAuthor.com, and of course, this vibrant debut in the Upper Country. I mentioned Soulfire Farm. Also drop a link there. Anywhere else you want to connect with listeners before we wrap up with your final piece of advice?
No, I mean, that's good. I'm not really on social media, so just, you know, visiting my publisher's websites is the best bet for that. But thank you so much for linking those other.
Of course. And maybe a review on Goodreads.
That you can, right. I will read it.
Very cool.
Read it.
Yeah, cool. All right. Kai, if you have a pearl of wisdom on for fellow scribes on just how to persevere, what would you drop?
I'm going to pick a little bit back up on what we were talking about earlier and just say, you know, there's a lot of good writers out there, and not to get caught up in the comparison, because what I've found is that it's fruitless. There's no point in doing so. Be the best that you can be, and don't be afraid of that imperfection, and just revisit and rework and rewrite. I think that is the thing that can bring about your best work.
I love it. Embracing imperfection is an important message to leave our listeners with. Again, thank you. Come back in the future. Would love to have you, and wish you the best of luck on your tour and with the farm.
Thanks so much, Kelton. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for joining us for this file. And if you're a fan of the show, simply head over to writerfiles.fm for more. That's writerfiles.fm.